Okay, so Brad, I don't know where I read this, but I wanted to throw this by you and get your thoughts on this. Pretend that life is somewhat like a video game, and as you walk around the world, you can see stats over other people's heads, floating above other people's heads. So my question to you is, what specific stat would you like to see floating above everyone's head? The one aspect of their personality, or their life, or their income, or their health, or what stat would you want to see over people's heads?
Wow, that's interesting. That's very, like, okay, so people in general or other cartoonists?
Oh, jeez, I don't know. I like how you immediately break it down.
I got two different answers for that.
People in general, and then we'll do other cartoonists, because I know your other cartoonist is going to be a snarky comment. So let's see. Oh. Let's do people in general first.
You know me too well. People in general, I would want to see which website they spend the most time on.
Oh, what? That, I did not expect you to say that. Wow, really? Okay.
Yeah. Because I think most of us do the greatest majority of
You'll always know when you walk by the lonely guy.
That's exactly it. I want to know what porn everybody is watching. No, I want to, because I think that's the most of, that's where most of us do most of our consumption of content these days. Unless you're like my wife would be no good for this, because she is constantly reading ebooks. So, you know, okay. she's a voracious reader, and she, her stats would be very boring. She'd be a lot of Instagram. She was just telling me this morning, I was grousing yet again, how I just can't get my head around Instagram and how I hate it so. And she's like, you don't understand. That's where everybody is now. That's where, she goes, all the bloggers I used to follow, they're on Instagram now. And I go, bloggers? How do you post a, you can't post a blog on Instagram. It's just photos. She says, no, you don't get it. That's what they're doing. So that was what I faced at 6 o'clock this morning as I was trying to drive her to work. But she'd be horrible at this, because most of her content is ebooks. You know, she doesn't do a lot of, you know, web surfing, even social media. She's not a whole lot.
Well, there's actually an argument to be made that she's living a healthier life than we're leading.
Oh, more than an argument. Believe me, I'm trying to be more like her.
So what would it tell you? What would it tell you about people, though, what website they're at? What would that give you? What insight would that give you to someone like at a party?
Oh, well, because I think I'll tell you exactly what my answer is there. I think we all pretend to be something we're not, except when nobody's looking. And that's usually when we've got time to ourselves surfing the web. And then what we do, what we really want to do. And I think it would strip away an awful lot of pretense. And say, hey, there's a lot of stuff that we all have in common that we pretend we don't. Guilty pleasures, for example, right? We especially at a social gathering, everybody's pretending to be this version of themselves that either A, they want to put forward into the world, or B, that they're afraid that their real version isn't acceptable. So they're going to be this other version that they think is more acceptable. And it would make it a little bit, you know, useless, fruitless to pretend if your top three websites were floating above your head.
All right, that's fair. And I got to tell you, I did not expect that as a statistic. So that's fun. All right. So now, what would you want to see for cartoonists floating above their head?
For cartoonists, you're right. This is, I don't know whether this is snarky or not, but I'd want to see a pie chart that breaks down how much time they spend working on their comic and how much time they spend doing other things that are unrelated. And in other words, I would break it down between comic, family time, and just healthy good things to do. You know, taking a walk out in the fall leaves with the person you love. So and a third part of the pie, which is just garbage stuff that we do, right? Video games. Well, maybe for me, it would be video games. And I say that not because I don't like video games, because I'm horrible at it. And for me, it's a wasted pursuit. But, you know, I would throw that kind of stuff, social media, stuff like that. where, you know, it's one thing if you're on there posting to, you know, to further yourself, but it's another thing if you're getting into these long, drawn out, you know, flame wars with somebody who just doesn't see the world the way you do, and you're going to straighten them out. I'd want a three-part pie chart that shows how much time you're spending. Because again, that would take a lot of pretense out too. It would be like, you know, if a cartoonist came up to me and was complaining about, you know, I'm not further in the world and I'm not doing this and I'm not doing that, or you know, the world isn't fair and there's all these reasons that I'm not successful and it has nothing to do with me. And then you'd look at their pie chart and you'd be able to tell, you know, where it get a little perspective on what they're saying.
So I like your construction. I like the way that you had it built. So I didn't anticipate this, but I'm going to do my answer the way you did your answer. So
okay.
For me, average people walking around or at a party, the number that I would want to see is, on a scale of 1 to 100, how funny is that person?
Now, wait a minute. There's different flavors of funny. How are you going to
I'm living in a world where stats are floating above their head. I can take it one step further and want a specific concrete number of how funny they are.
That's a good point. So they've got a funny rating, like almost like an IQ quotient. It's a funny rating.
Exactly. So, and I'll tell you why. My wife and I, like when we do like Upright Citizens Brigade or something like that, it takes us 6 to 8 months of people on our team to know who's a really funny one, who you can really rely on as the funny one, who's your go-to to make you laugh. And how great would it be to go through life and go, oh, I want to meet that person. They're a 98. Oh, Brad, we got to go talk to that person.
That's true.
I think just
because you've got to wade through a lot of 12s before you find a 98.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of dad jokes before you get to someone who's truly like third level joking. And frankly, I'm floating above my head would just be Dad Joke Central. It wouldn't even be a number. It would just say Dad Joke Central. But I think that'd be a fun way to go through life because you could really gravitate towards the fun people. Because I like to fill my life with people that make me laugh, bring me joy. And I think that'd be an amazing shortcut. So that's that.
Oh.
And then for cartoonists, here's where I get Machiavellian. I would want to know two stats. I would want to know the final line, the net that they put on their W-2 when they file their taxes.
Really?
Yeah. And then I would want to know the pie chart of all their income sources. And because I would want to be like, walking through Emerald City Comic Con or San Diego Comic Con and going, geez, that guy's at $350,000 a year. What's he doing? And then you walk over and it's like, oh, he's doing, you know, I don't know, paid content for Blick.com or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
And you're like, I never would have guessed to do that sort of thing. Like, I have a feeling that every once in a while with a cartoonist, if you scratch the surface, you'd find a source of income that you're like, I've never explored that.
Yeah.
I should do that.
Well, and it also would address a little bit of this grass is greener stuff that we always go through, right? And so we independents always look at somebody who's published by a corporation and we assume that they must have it so much better.
Yeah.
Right. Oh my gosh, they must be getting, you know, six figure advances and they're getting flown everywhere in gold plated jets And meanwhile, I guarantee you that many people who come from traditional publishing take a look at independents and are assume that every Kickstarter we do is a $200,000 Kickstarter and that we're keeping $200,000 when we do it. And it would take a lot of that grass is greener stuff right out of the mix.
Yeah, absolutely. And because we both know too that you could be a cartoonist who's Instagram famous or Twitter famous, and yet be making Midwest starter income kind of a levels. It'd be fun to know if a cartoonist is Midwest rich, New York rich. That kind of difference.
Yeah, it's different being Philadelphia rich and being Bad Axe Michigan rich.
Yeah,
those are two different riches.
I know that when I go to visit friends that live like in Texas or in the Midwest there, and it's like, yeah, I just got this 7-bedroom house for $40,000. I'm like, I will drive this ice pick through your head. $40,000 for a 7-bedroom house. In California, you couldn't get a one-bedroom bachelor pad for $40,000.
You can't get a good refrigerator-sized cardboard box for that.
You can get a swift kick in the ass for that amount. That's what you can get.
You can get the hell out of my retail. God damn it. I had that fucking punchline and I screwed it up.
That's all
you
right.
can get the hell out of my realtor office.
I'll save you, Brad, by saying hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics
and making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. And Dave, how's everything going over there today?
I tell you what, Brad, I'm getting excited because in 2 weeks, Brad Geiger is coming to Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
For Patricon, which is the big convention. Not big convention. What am I talking about? It's a get-together that Patreon offers.
It's a big deal. Listen, if I'm coming out there, it's a big deal.
When Brad Geiger's involved, it's big. It's Gabby
That's
Hayes
right.
big. So Brad's coming out. We're going to be listening in on talks and speeches, a lot of which we are going to be sharing with our audience on Comic Lab and also with our Patreon audience. Tips and tricks and insights into how Patreon is working best for people, how to improve your own numbers as a cartoonist. And so I'm really excited for the 3 or 4 days we're going to have of pretty intense learning about the Patreon platform.
Yeah.
And also of hanging out with Brad at nighttime. That's going to be super fun.
I'm looking forward to it. It's the first time I will have done any major traveling in a couple of years in terms of like going to something comics related like that. So I'm very much looking forward to doing it.
I can't wait. And I can't wait to do all the sort of sleepover tricks. Like when Brad's sleeping in my house, I'm going to get a little bowl of warm water and just put his hand in there. make him wet
you
the
don't
bed.
Need to go through all the trouble. I'll pee the bed one way or the other.
You're like, you don't know how old I am. Listen, I'll pee that bed. No problem at all.
Save the bowl. You're going through a lot of extra steps. Let's cut out the middleman.
Just give me a third of a glass of water before bed. That's all it takes.
That's right. That's right. And that's after my fifth glass of wine over dinner.
That's right. All right. Well, Bradley J, let's get started, because this question leads us into Patreon and so Patricon. And so this is a fun one to sort of transition into.
Yeah.
So Brad and Dave, this is a $5 question from one of our Patreon backers, by the way. Brad and Dave, do you have any tips or lessons you've learned about how to hustle effectively, how to network? And then, so I direct that question to you, Brad Guidley. Brad Guidley?
Guidley?
Brad Guidley?
That sounds like an adverb. Like if somebody's really horrible at podcasting, they say, well, he's okay, but he's pretty Guidley.
Brad Guidley. Brad Guidley sounds like a show host from a 1950s game show. All righty, it's Brad Guidley.
Oh, you're really good at that. You've got that game show's swing down pat. Listen, was there a better game show theme song than Match Game?
There was.
Do you remember the Match Game theme song?
I do remember that. I didn't want to stop you because that is very enjoyable. But the 70s were like the primo time if you were a jingle writer to get that gig writing for game shows.
Oh, yeah. Between game shows and TV sitcoms, it was the golden age of jingle writers. You know, every TV show had to have a jingle that told you what the show was about, from the Brady Bunch to Gilligan's Island to the Addams Family set everything up. And then TV game shows, forget about it.
Yeah. Well, as a TV writer, my wife was telling me the other day, and I never even thought about this, that the shrinking amount of time that they give to TV sitcoms, you used to have upwards of 45 seconds for a theme song, which when you're Cheers or Friends or the Cosby Show, you could really establish a mood. And then by the time she got to How I Met Your Mother, I think it was like 20 seconds. And then now it can be as short as 5 or 10 seconds for a theme song.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. And it kind of is a fading art, that intro song that you used to have in the 70s or 80s.
Well, I think that has a lot to do with attention span, too. I don't think you'd get today's audience to sit through a theme song like Gilligan's Island. They'd be flipping the channel by the time you got to the Professor and Marianne.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And Netflix completely removes it by the time you get to the second show if you're binging, you know. So
yeah, yeah. Oh, I got to tell you, I love Skip Intro. I've been pathing through all of the Monty Python TV shows, which is a really delightful span of time to go back and relive. But as much as I love that that's a symphonic intro of Monty Python's, I always hit Skip Intro.
That's amazing. Like, oh, I love this. Couldn't love it more. Skip. Skip.
Well, and you know, I think Graham Chapman is kind of an underrated animator. Like all the stuff that he was doing during that time was so unique and inventive. I think he's an unsung hero. You never talk about, you know, when you're talking about the greats in animation, Graham Chapman's name doesn't come up an awful lot. But gee whiz, when you look at the stuff he was doing, man, he was just innovating his butt off week after week.
Was it Graham Chapman doing it though? I don't think it was.
Did I get that wrong? I thought it was Graham Chapman who did the animations.
I thought it was Terry Gilliam.
You may be right.
The guy that directed Brazil.
You may be right.
Well, I don't need to win this one. Who cares? It doesn't matter. But you're right. The thing though, we can both agree that the animation on Monty Python, like, achieved a lot with a very cheap effect, you know?
Yeah.
Which as web cartoonists, we can high five. We can appreciate that.
that was the way to go. Oh, you know what? I think you're right. I think Terry Gilliam, I'm looking at the picture and I know that face was the, you are right. I will give it to you.
All right,
I know him by his face more than I know him by his name.
Yeah, that's okay. All right. So now you've effectively dodged the question for 2 minutes.
God,
now.
I hate this. No.
Brad Geiger, do you have any tips or lessons about how to hustle effectively? How do you do it, Brad?
Okay. So there's one thing that bugs me here and I want to see if you caught it too. I don't like that he's equating hustling with networking. Because hustling to me is a completely different topic than networking. Hustling, when we talk about, I can, like we've said in the past, you know, I can out hustle anyone. There might be somebody out there who can draw better than I can or can write better than I can,
but I can out hustle them.
When we say hustling, we're not talking about hustling the way you'd hustle somebody over a game of billiards. We're talking about hard work,
right.
Like working hard, taking on a large number, a large volume of work, putting out work at a steady pace. When we're talking hustling, we're actually talking about working at a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10. We're not talking about hustling a game of pool or, you know, in other words, it's not a sly kind of positioning oneself and sidling up and doing it. So the way this person is equating hustling with networking is making me really, really uncomfortable. So let's separate those things. Any tip for hustling? That's a time management thing. That's a perseverance thing. That's a priority thing. Hustling, my tips on hustling is to give comics the proper priority in your life. Doesn't mean necessarily that it's number one just yet, but it's higher than a lot of other things that aren't taking you to where you want to be in life. Right. So your relationship with your significant other might be number one, or your family might be number one. Your work that's paying the mortgage might be at a slightly higher priority. But then comics comes at a high priority in its proper place. And you work your tail off to get to where you want to be. That's the kind of hustling that we're talking about. Now, networking. That's a completely different subject. That's making friends, making contacts, and that is nothing more for me than simple social graces, politeness, being kind, not overstepping your bounds, and not overstating your case. It for me at a comic convention, it was always when this guy came up and gave me his business card, and he'd walk away, and I'd be like, "Why did you give me your business card? We haven't talked. I totally admit that's what goes out of my head. We haven't talked.
No, you're not wrong.
We haven't talked about doing business. I don't know you. I don't know any. You just walked up and introduced yourself and gave me a business card, and we had a chat about the weather, and you walked away. What was that supposed to happen? If I want to do business with you, then we should exchange cards. But otherwise, I don't need your business. I've got a stack of business cards because some of them I threw away on the spot, but a lot of them because of Catholic guilt, I held on to and brought them back on the plane. And I still have a stack of them sitting here in the freaking studio. But networking is about making honest connections with people, going up and being honestly interested in what the other person is doing, not coming up and trying to get the other person interested in you. That's not networking.
Right.
Networking is when you make a connection based on your willingness to know about the other person. And then that's how a relationship starts. Not coming up and selling me on the wonderfulness that is you. But instead, having a enjoyable talk where the conversation goes both ways, that's kind of the basis of networking. And then playing it cool, being not sending 10 follow-up emails after that or anything like that, but being available to any amount of interaction that happens after that. That's, to me, good networking. But Dave, what do you think about this question?
Well, first of all, I think you're right. So the word hustle I would avoid too, because like you said, hustling to me implies a certain smarmy kind of mafioso type, like, yeah, we got the hustle going on this guy.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that was just a poorly chosen word. But I think focusing on networking, I think you're right. And the way that I would construct it is this. Networking can be done either in a kind way or even in a Machiavellian way, but both of them will end up looking kind of similar. And here's what I mean by that. When you're doing it in a kind way, what you're doing is, oh, hey, Dave, this is Brad Geiger. Oh, hey, Brad, how are you? Hey, I like your work. I've read Evil Inc. online. Oh, thanks a lot. Hey, so can I ask you, since we're meeting, how do you do your line art for some of your action scenes? It's really good. And then you start a conversation. No big deal, right? You're just a normal person. It's no different than it was in high school, frankly. Mm-hmm. It's you express interest in what they have to say. You engage in active listening. You parlay back and forth on shared topics that you're both interested in, and you part ways, right? That's the normal way to do it. Is ideally, you are listening more than you're talking, and you're being delightful. You're being funny. You're being kind. And that's how you part, right? And then from that first conversation, probably 80% of the conversations at a Comic-Con, say, they don't go anywhere further than that. You've now met someone. Great. They're in your sort of mental Rolodex, but there's no further exchange until maybe the next Comic-Con that you see them at, right? But it's the beginning of a relationship. Over 3, 4, 5, 6 years, and enough of those conversations, you will have networked enough where one of you could ask the other one for a favor or that kind of thing. That sort of thing can happen. And then there's the Machiavellian way to do it, which is you basically look at life as the Godfather Part 2, which is you go around offering people favors. And then in so doing, you accrue a sort of mental and emotional debt. And by being kind, quote unquote, but being kind in a Machiavellian way, you can 2 years from now ask them how they do their printing or how they do their line work or who do they recommend for pins. Or I'm just imagining whatever system you would want to ask a question about.
Yeah.
And so the idea there is that but in both cases, the reason why I said they're kind of similar, in both cases, you are giving more than you are receiving at first. And that's the sort of trick about human nature. Is that people immediately put their hackles up and their guard up, rightly so, when you go, hey, I'm Brad Geiger. Hey, can I ask you 5 things? Can I get a favor from you? Can you also do this for me? Can you help me? What can you do for me? Because Brad goes, A, who are you? B, no, fuck off, go away. I don't want to deal with you right now. In a sort of basic human way, you have to offer more than you take. And that's how you build relationships. But ideally, I would prefer that you do it in the non-Machiavellian way. You just do it in the normal human way, which is, oh, hey, nice to meet you.
Listen, please don't be that second guy. please don't be that second person, right? Where you're doing it in a Machiavellian way, because number one, it smells from 100 yards off. It's the worst way to do it. And by the way, we've all gotten that email where the email opens with, hey, you may not be remember me, but I was that guy that, you know, brought you lunch at Wizard World Cincinnati. And then ham-handedly transitions over into, I thought you might like to know I'm doing a Kickstarter, and if you'd like to help promote it, or if you'd like to make a pledge, here it is. But when they open up with, here's that thing I did for you, and then it ham-handedly transitions into, now here's the thing that I want you to do for me. That's the worst, absolute worst way to ask somebody for a favor is by reminding them of what a great person you were, 3 years ago or whatever. Don't be that right. person, man. That's a little social grace that you should have learned by now. We've all gotten into a situation where we've got to ask somebody a favor, or we want to promote something, and that means reaching out to other people and so forth. But there's a finesse way to do that, and there's a ham-handed way to do that. And boy, just put a little thought into that. You know how many spams we get from people who we originally thought were very nice people, and all of a sudden I get spammed on their Kickstarter through a personal email that I know that I never handed my email to anybody because I don't hand out cards. It's like, how did you get my email for this? You got to hit unsubscribe and, you know, report it as spam and all this other stuff. It's like, come on, have a little bit of sense when you're doing this. So much of this comes in down to basic politeness.
Right. Well, it's also the best way to look at it is what you're really doing when you're networking is you're building up friendships.
Yes.
Now, you may not be building up best friends. You may not even be building friendships that you can call up and just talk about your day. But it's sort of industry friends where you're like, I like and respect you.
Right.
You like and respect me. Let's be nice to each other.
Yeah.
You know, and in general, as a life policy, if you can be a giver more than a taker, then in a moment of crisis, you will find that other humans will come to your aid when you need it, which is, and it's not necessarily like, oh, no, I have cancer. It's, oh, I have a Kickstarter, or, oh, I'm doing a new project. Like if Brad is doing something without even asking, there's enough friendship there where I would just retweet whatever he's doing that if it's a Kickstarter or that sort of thing. You know what I mean? And that's what you want to get to, is that you basically want to get to such a level of giving that on the rare occasions where you need to take, it's frictionless, you know?
Yep. Oh, and here's another one. Especially when we're talking about promoting money things like Patreon and Kickstarter, there's a lot of people that retweet me so often that I see their little avatar pop up in my retweets because I check that every day. Who's retweeting me, you know, because not out of, you know, am I important today, but out of, am I doing something that's working? And if I, through plain old math, if I keep seeing your face retweeting me, when I see you saying something that needs a little amplification on Twitter, it's second nature. Of course I'm going to do that.
Yep.
Because I appreciate when I see that you are doing it for me. So if you want to see me promote your Kickstarter, number one, show up in my notifications a lot. To be honest,
slide up in Brad's DMs is what he's saying.
That's right. And number two, here's and okay, so let's say you don't want to promote the kind of crap that I do. That's fine. There's another way. Do a really fun Kickstarter that people want to share. In other words, not here's my book, give me money, but something that is fun, a fun stretch goal, a fun way of talking about what you're doing. Like Dave is great at this. A funny video. When Dave launches a Kickstarter, I know I'm always going to be sharing his video, not necessarily because I want somebody to know about Anatomy of Animals, although I do. But mainly because he does a really funny video that I know that people are going to enjoy if they watch it. That's and the Kickstarter is secondhand. This is a funny video. This is something worth sharing, right?
Right.
So
right.
That's your two ways of getting somebody to help promote. But to the deeper core of networking, Dave hit the nail right on the head. It's about being a friend. It's about being kind and polite and not overstepping.
And decent, frankly.
Yeah. 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 And just kind of reading the room. Oh my gosh, how many times
reading the room.
How
oh,
many
boy.
Times do I tell my boys, listen, my older son Alex just started an internship with 1812 Productions, which is the oldest continuously running comedy theater group in the United States. Right.
Wow.
Oh, we're really excited. And he's having such a great time. But on his first day over, when he went over there, I said, now, listen, when you get in there, read the room. You know, I know you're excited. And I know he really is interested in writing comedy and this kind of stuff. And I go, but listen, you're in there as an internship. If they tell you to hold a light and point it at this person's face, then that's what you're going to do for the next hour.
Right,
you know, if they
right.
tell you to hold a microphone, you're going to hold a microphone. And he did a wonderful job. And as a result of him not going in and barnstorming the place, about halfway through, they started asking him what his thoughts were on certain content issues and some of the things that they could cover. And all of a sudden, he was taking part in the creative aspect as well as the nuts and bolts stuff that his internship was supposed to be doing. And how did that happen? Because the kid knows how to read a room. That's a great right. skill to develop, right?
Right. Well, okay, so I want to take two completely opposing attitudes about reading the room, Brad.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a great point. And you tell me which one you think is truer, okay? So point one is that I would argue that one of the reasons why I still go to Comic-Con is that there is something about human contact that is still vital. And what I mean by that is at every Comic-Con I go to, I end up meeting 10, 15, 20, 30 other cartoonists, of which maybe three or four I'll have really good rapport and conversations with, right? And of those three or four, that will turn into a valuable relationship down the road that I'll cherish and that I have a new buddy that I can lean on, that kind of a thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's an argument there for Comic-Cons and continuing to network, right? All that sort of stuff. But
yeah.
Here's the other flip side argument that I kind of want to make, and I want to get your reading on. Maybe it's possible to be a web cartoonist and a successful web cartoonist with no networking at all. What do you think about that?
Oh, I think it's absolutely possible, because in the case that you're talking about, it wasn't you going up and speaking on your behalf. It was your work that speaks on your behalf. And that, in my opinion, is something that is aspirational. I think that's something that more of us, me included, should be working towards, getting to that point where our work speaks on our behalf.
Right, right. I, frankly, I'm trying to think on a day-to-day basis how much I need to network or rely on friends, or if I just suss out and figure out things on my own, I can figure out 95% of what a web cartoonist needs to do on my own. I can.
You're right.
With my work, I can reach 95% of the people I want to reach on my, I mean, maybe I'm oversimplifying, but I think I know of a few cartoonists who I've seen them once in 15 years because they don't talk to anybody, and yet they're doing just fine. You know, they cocoon in their weird little antisocial shell and they're doing just fine. So maybe networking, I mean, this is why I say it's a flip side. Because I know on a human level that I have appreciated and liked and gained from my relationships with other cartoonists. But maybe the flip side is also true. Maybe you don't have to be a networking cartoonist to be a successful cartoonist.
Oh, I think you're absolutely that you're dead on from that one. You do not have to do that.
Yeah, I think maybe. And on that note, this has been the last Comic Lab you'll ever hear, guys, because Brad and I don't need to network with each other anymore.
That's right, Dave. With that piece of information, I have officially learned everything there is to learn from you.
All right, Brad. So why don't we jump into the second question? Do you want to read it, my friend, or shall I read it?
Yeah, that sounds good. I'll give it a crack here. Guys, after taking your advice and putting out a survey I discovered my primary demographic was 18 to 24-year-old males. Then it struck me. I wasn't really sure what to do with this information. Are there any good resources or studies out there about the different primary demographics with specific relation to media consumption? I ask you, David Kellett.
Well, let me tell you, as America's foremost specialist on demographics and psychographics, this is going to be about an hour, hour and a half talk. So if everybody wants to get coffee.
Settle in.
And settle in. Old Grandpa Kellett is going to take you through demographics. No, I will tell you, Brad, that this is something that I have paid very little attention to in my own career. And when I say very little, I mean for passingly, and for about 30 seconds, I'll go, huh, look at that. I'm popular among 35-year-old females. All right, well, click away. And then like, what do I do with that? I don't know what to do with that. So popular with 18 to 24-year-old males, my immediate thought is, all right, you've got to get that Axe Body Spray sponsorship. That is your ticket to a solid gold
car. That's right. That's right. Let's get a move on.
Let's get that. Let's get some acne cream sponsorships. Let's get some Axe Body Spray sponsorships. You are going to be riding high with cash, my friend. 18 to 24-year-old males. Then it struck me I wasn't totally sure what to do with this information. Are there any good... And I'll tell you why. Okay, I want to focus on this. It struck me I wasn't totally sure what to do with this information. Because here is my thought. Marketing aside, put that aside. Let's focus on the creation of the comic. For the most part, you don't want anything external to impact the joy that you have from creating your comic the way you are enjoying creating it. So if I were to say to you, hey, if you just change all your punch signs to include the word Axe Body Spray, you'll get way more readers, right? This is a bad example, but because it sounds like marketing, but you know what I'm getting at. I don't think you want the demographics to ever impact how you write because they've already found you. They've already liked you. The trick is just to continue to find the joy in your own writing, in your own drawing, and then the audience will continue to find that. They'll see that spark of joy in there. But when you start to write to a demographic, when you start to tailor your comic, there's a little bit of not phoniness, but just maybe it is phoniness. There's a little bit of phoniness and a little bit of a decreased natural joy that you have in your comic. And I don't want you to do that. But as far as marketing, Brad, why don't you take a stab at that? How would you approach this? You found out that you have 18 to 24-year-old males, and we can broaden that out. You found you have 40 to 50-year-old Midwest mothers of two, Brad, is your demographic. What do you do with that information?
Well, I'm going to back up the truck just for a second here because although I know what you're saying. In other words, you should not do a comic – go back to the early 2000s when I was trying to become a syndicated newspaper cartoonist, or actually go back even further, late 90s. I was trying to become a syndicated newspaper cartoonist, and I had read that there was this huge trend of what they called the boomerang generation, which was young people graduating from college and then coming back to live with their parents. And as a newspaper, as somebody trying to do newspapers, I knew that newspaper editors were always looking for demographics. They were always looking for demographic comics because they didn't read the comics. They didn't care about the comics. But if somebody told them, hey, I've got a comic that addresses XYZ demographic, and that by running that comic, you could be viewed as servicing that demographic, then they were more apt to do it. So I started trying to develop a boomeranger comic. The problem was, and by the way, all of that is valid. The problem, as Dave is going to tell you right off the bat, and this is the point that I think you're making, since my heart wasn't in that, I hadn't had kids of my own yet, and that wasn't my own, that wasn't my experience. I moved out and stayed out. Once I realized that we were allowed to leave Bad Axe, I got the heck out. There was 18 years. Nobody told me I was allowed to leave, you know, but once I realized that they weren't locking the gate at night, pew, I was out of there.
They weren't locking the gate at night. I like the idea like there's a dome over Bad Axe. You're like, well, I guess I'm getting that job as a manager of Dairy Queen. That's my future.
That's right. That's right. But my heart wasn't in it. It wasn't. And it's not to say that I couldn't have been successful, but my chances of success were really slim. I would have had to been really a talented writer. And at that point, I really wasn't. But now let's take that whole idea and put it on its ear. And we've talked about this a number of times, or I know I have on different shows. But Scott Kurtz talks about developing Table Titans. And the reason that he started thinking about Table Titans, he wanted to do a new project. And his manager, Corey Cassoni, was looking at demographic numbers and said, oh, my gosh, there's this huge upswelling of tabletop gaming and nobody's addressing it. The Penny Arcade guys are not addressing it. Their conventions didn't address it at that time. The second PAX Unplugged is coming to Philadelphia this November. So they've come around. But it was an underserved market, but it was burgeoning. But there wasn't a lot of stuff out there content-wise for people who love that. And now it fit because Scott had a long, deep history of D&D gaming, particularly,
right,
and a love of tabletop, board games and stuff like that. It was he couldn't have manufactured it, but if it hadn't have been for at least looking at the demographics,
yeah,
they would have never even attempted that. They might have tried any number of different things.
Okay, yeah, no, I'll grant you that one. Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. But now let's get down to the question that he's actually asking.
But before we move on, though, the key thing that we have to go back on is Brad saying that Scott couldn't and didn't manufacture that interest. Because his demographic had said, boy, for some reason, your readers really love tearaway basketball pants. They just love them. They loved it. They're really into tearaway basketball pants. Can we do a strip about tearaway basketball pants? He would look at that and go, there's no spark of interest there. There's no shared Venn diagram of I'm also interested in this. It just so happened, Brad, that we know that Scott loved D&D anyway. He loved tabletop gaming. He loved that kind of role-playing. So it was all kind of a match made in heaven when that demographic revealed itself.
Yes.
So
it was organic.
But had Scott been handed a sheet that said, boy, your 18 to 24 year old readers really love tearaway basketball pants, he would have been like, I guess I gotta do old tearaway pants, the new comic from Scott Kurtz. He wouldn't have done it.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Or if he would have tried, he would have most likely failed.
Right.
Because it really wasn't in his heart.
Right.
But so, yeah, I think that's worth underlining that it does need to be organic. But let's go even deeper because we're dancing around the question this person's actually asking. And I love the question. Because it was something, there's a lot of times I hear a question and I know the answer immediately, or being more truthful with myself, I think I know the answer immediately, right? And then I start thinking about it and maybe I was right, maybe I was wrong, but it leads me down a path of a lot of thoughts. And this was a great question because I drew a complete blank. And that tells me that there's some research that is going to be valuable. Like I'm going to discover something. And so I immediately went out and I started trying to find sources for this. I wanted to know the answer to this question. And I'm telling you, I came up completely empty. Like trying to find resources, there was a lot of companies that would read the tea leaves, that would take a look at reader surveys and give you feedback. But that was a service, like a four-pay service. In terms of pointing you towards a book that you could read, I was able to find none. Pointing you towards a website that you could, even if it was a subscription website, saying, okay, here's some stuff that they're posting there, that I couldn't find anything that filled this need. So I, in a certain extent, now I'm on the hunt for this too. So although I can't give you the answer that you're looking for, I can tell you how I address this in my professional life and how I think an awful darn lot of us okay. address this in our personal lives. And that is this. Exactly. Go back and re-listen to the beginning of this topic. And what did Dave say? Well, if you've got 18 to 24-year-old male listeners, you want to start that Axe body spray, a commercial. He was saying that in jest, but he's doing exactly what I want you, the question asker, to do. And that is use your common sense. And not in a, this is the comic I'm going to do. Your comic is your comic. Your comic has already attracted these people. So you don't need to, it doesn't have to be like an echo chamber where you keep feeding this information in and getting the same results. But when you're talking about things like merchandising, or when you're talking about maybe, approaches to marketing and so forth, you should absolutely be using some common sense there. Merchandising and things of that nature, you might have, if you have it, we were talking last episode on pro tips about merchandise, socks for merchandise, right?
Right.
You might be more apt to do one type of merchandise that you can see that 18 to 24-year-old males might be more apt to purchase than something else.
Yep.
Right? And also in terms of your marketing. Okay. Now let's and by the way, a lot of what I'm going to say is going to be very stereotypical, but I'm not saying that to stereotype. Because when we're talking about this topic, we have to speak in generalities, because I'm going to tell you that if you want to attract the attention of 18 to 24-year-old males, you're going to be using sex. You're going to be using, sexy images, typically of women. Now, I know that there's an awful lot of 18 to 24-year-old males that are not going to react to sexy images of women. I get that. But we're talking in broad generalities. We're talking about throwing big nets out. So, yeah, you're going to be doing the same kind of outreach that Budweiser does, because guess what? That's their demographic too, 18 to 24-year-old males. And you're going to be doing sports-related metaphors in your marketing. And you're going to be choosing your social media based on that. Let's move away from 18 to 24-year-old males. Let's say it was 18 to 24-year-old females. Well, we know from reading and following certain social media that Instagram tends to be leans a little bit female to male ratio. It has a high female to male ratio. Pinterest, oh my gosh, Pinterest has a very high female to male ratio in its user base. So you're going to use stuff like that, and you're going to say, okay, where am I? And now I know who my readers are. Now let's use some common sense, and let's let that help us. Like if you're down between one thing and another, that's where your demographics might sway you in one direction on some of these things. But making specific decisions based on demographics, not a great idea. But common sense decisions, okay, let's say you've got older readers. That there's another demographic we can go okay. down on. Well, what can you assume about older readers?
They're all going to die.
Well, they've been working for a little bit longer. They're not at entry-level jobs, so they have more disposable income, right? So now instead of releasing paperback books, you might be releasing hardcover collections, things that are a little bit more expensive. But if your readers are in that, $45 to $55 range, they're not like I put a price tag on every person I meet, but if you can make the logical conclusion that your readers might tend to have more disposable income, that's going to determine the merchandise that you're going to release, right? What do you think about that?
No, Dave? I think you're right. I think a modification that I want to say to demographics or psychographics, whichever you want to use, is that, for me, they're helpful when you have a fork in the road. And what I mean by that is they're helpful when you have two choices that you could go down, two roads you could go down, both of which you're pretty comfortable with. But it's like, well, let's consult the demographics and see which one my readers like. And then it's more of a of a group decision in the sense of, Brad, I could either do a pug book this spring or I could do a coffee book this spring. And I'm happy to do either one. Oh, gosh, my demographic's really swinging towards coffee readers. So you know what? Why fight? Mm-hmm. Why swim upstream? I'll do the coffee book. Okay, great. So I use the demographics for a fork in the road decision. And then another one might be fork in the road. What was the other one I was going to say? Oh, gosh, I completely blanked on it. Another one might be when you're old and you just long for the sweet release of death because your memory has failed you.
I've been there.
I don't remember what the I wanted to make about demographics, and that is that is when you do. Oh, I know what I was going to say. Fork in the road decisions, I think, are good as an individual web cartoonist. And then, frankly, I personally think that demographics are more helpful when you are a company or a producer or something that is at bigger scale. And what I mean by that is you're producing like 40 SKUs or 40 items a year. And so like you're a maker of widgets, you know what I mean? And when you are making 40, 50, 100 widgets, knowing your demographics knows, okay, well then all things being equal, let's just make widget A instead of widget B because that's what our demographic likes. Yeah. But for me as a creator, one of the things that I was saying that demographics mean less to me is that I don't scale. I create what is personal and important to me. And so decisions of A versus B are less likely because I'm not producing 100 widgets, all of which could make me money. I'm producing a comic that is personal to me and the products that are based on that comic that are also still personal to me. So for me personally, I don't use demographics as much as, say, a 400-person company that makes a couple different dozen widgets. And so that's Brad and I probably differ a little bit on that, on how demographics can be helpful. But for me, I have in the past used them for fork in the road decisions, but I think most likely they're most useful for when you're a company at scale that has a lot of different directions they could go. And so demographics are a guiding light, mm-hmm. or psychographics are a guiding light. Brad, what do you think of that?
No, I agree. Listen, I like the idea of doing reader surveys. I like the idea of kind of knowing in general terms where my audience is skewing because I do think it helps make a lot of those merchandise right. and promotional and kind of decisions. But you have an absolute great point in that you don't want to go overboard with that. You don't want to get to the point where you're making creative decisions based on that because right. you're created. Right. Your creativity should be coming from a different place than that. And that's just a really good way to get you paint yourself into a corner where you're trying to do stuff based on the demographics instead of where your heart is. And that's never a good place to come from creatively. So yeah, I agree with you in that respect.
Well, all right. Well, this is a question, Brad. Our next reader question is more directed towards your specialties than mine. So I'm going to direct this one to you. Brad and Dave, my question is about book distribution. I am starting to reach out to local book distribution companies about carrying my all-ages titles and was wondering if you had any advice in that area. I know Brad's books are on Amazon and thought that might be an area to explore. Brad, what do you think?
Oh, what a great question. Well, yeah. Listen, so here's the deal on book distribution. I'm really, really strongly in favor of self-publishing to the extent that I get my books distributed widely. In other words, it goes much beyond what I have on my website for sale. I like selling stuff on the web, but book distribution has an awful lot of advantages. I certainly make more money when I sell something directly on my site. And for many, many years, I was really adamant. I wanted you to buy it from my site. These days, not so much. These days, I'm very happy to send a few hundred books to a distributor and take a smaller cut, so I don't have to package them up and drop them at the post office and stuff like that. I can take a smaller cut and use my time a little bit more wisely. So let's talk about book distribution for comics specifically. And number one, we got to talk about Diamond Comics distribution. Diamond Comics did something, and I got to go back and see what year they did this. For a while, everybody was putting their stuff out through Diamond, and then Diamond was getting way too much from independent publishers. And they kind of put the brakes on, and they put out this notice that said, we will promote your book, we'll put it in the catalog and all like this. But if your book doesn't get a certain number, a certain threshold of orders from retailers, we're gonna cancel the order from everybody, and we're just gonna call it a push. In other words, let's say you needed 100 orders and you only got 50. Well, all those 50, the people that had ordered the 50 copies, they're going to get a return saying, nope, this one is not going to get fulfilled and you're not going to get the order at all. Well, this had a big cooling effect for self-publishers on Diamond. Since then, I don't know that Diamond has ever announced it, but I can tell you that I've experienced very little pushback getting my stuff out on Diamond. In fact, I would strongly recommend soliciting your book with Diamond. And for our Patreon backers, I'll link to a PDF that has information specifically from Diamond Comics about submitting to Diamond and what you have to go through and all of those kind of details. I'll make that available to our Patreon backers along with this podcast. But this is the heart of the matter here. Here's why I list my books with Diamond. Because I really don't care whether comic shops carry this thing, and I don't care whether bookstores carry this thing. But when I list it through Diamond, when it goes out to Amazon, I get listed on Amazon.com as a primary seller. In other words, I get listed the same way that a book from Simon & Schuster gets listed. It's not a third-party vendor. And if you look at Amazon, sometimes when you get a third-party vendor, the design is slightly different. And things like being available for prime shipping is gone. And that has a dampening effect on sales. I want to be listed on Amazon.com as a primary vendor, and having them out through Diamond is a very easy way for me to thread that needle. Okay. So, and that's very important to me. I don't want to look like a third-party vendor. I want my stuff to be available for Amazon Prime free shipping and all of those things. So putting it out through Diamond is a great way to do that, because that's where the sales are. Amazon is where people are buying books. Comic shop, it's great. If a comic shop is carrying me, I'm thrilled. Same thing with a brick-and-mortar bookstore. But the real game, as we all know, is Amazon.com. And I want to optimize what's happening on Amazon. Now, if Diamond isn't the right fit for you, or if for somehow, some reason, it's not working out, you tried it and it doesn't work out, there are a couple ways to get on Amazon that you can get on and your stuff is presented in a primary publisher kind of way. I first started doing Seller Central on Amazon, and I still have a Seller Central account, and it's very good, but that's a little bit more, you get listed as a third party. However, Amazon Advantage is set up specifically for independent publishers. And if you sign up with Amazon Advantage, it's a consignment deal, where you ship them a certain number of books, they sell them, and then you get you get paid based on the number that were sold. So you don't get paid up front, but then again, you rarely get paid up front in distribution right. deals anyway. I would definitely look into Amazon Advantage. I've had a lot of luck with that. It's unfortunately it's Amazon, so the user experience in terms of actually going through and figuring out how to upload things and the right way to do. Amazon's not great when it comes to user experience in terms of getting your stuff listed on their site. I've never been thrilled with anything I've had to do with Amazon in terms of just tell me what I need to do. Give right. me the thing I need to do it.
Right. Give me a checklist of 10 things and I will do the 10 things. Yeah.
Yeah. Amazon for me is horrible. But it's worth sticking with and hanging with for a little bit. My first answer is Diamond Comics Distribution. And if as a backup, I would point you towards Amazon Advantage. What do you think?
Okay, so can I ask you, I want to pepper you with a bunch of questions about this, because this is a world that I know very little about. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I'm both fascinated by it and deterred by it, by, as you described, the sort of interface written by an engineer in terms of trying out Amazon as a seller, right? So here's my question for you.
Yeah.
I'm looking at, I searched for Brad Geiger on Amazon, and there's 10 or 15 titles that came up, all of which look great. They're all presented in the mm-hmm. normal and not, I know what you mean. They don't look like the skeevy third party OEM manufacturer out of Shanghai that is being listed on Amazon where you're like, what am I buying? Yeah. But okay. So, the books look great. They're all listed as by Brad Geiger. If I click on one of these books, mm-hmm. who fulfills this? Amazon. So you have some warehousing, maybe 100, 200 sitting in a warehouse somewhere. Yeah.
Well, okay. I've got a backup. If it's, so it depends. If it's a listing that I listed through Seller Central, which I still keep active, Seller Central, I get the order and I fulfill it.
Okay.
If it's a book that's out there through Diamond, what happens is I list it in Diamond. Diamond comes back and says, okay, we'll make an order of 200 books. Then I package up 200 books, and Diamond has a lot of requirements for how you ship their stuff as well. That's not super easy to slog through, but you got to do what you got to do. But then I'll package up 20 books. Some of them go to Olive Branch. Some of them go to this other place. It's to their different warehouses. And now I've got stuff in the pipeline. And if it was something that was a Diamond listing, that's being handled through Diamond. And if it's one of the Amazon Advantage listings, then that's also, they've got a bunch of books that they ordered. I sent them out. It's much smaller numbers. But then they do the fulfillment, and I get a check for every book
okay.
that gets sold. So my suggestion to you, don't screw around with Seller Central on Amazon. Do Amazon Advantage. And before you do either of those, try Diamond first.
Okay, so this is great. That's getting to my second question, which is why did you do all three?
Because Diamond, there was a time that I was getting a little bit frustrated with Diamond. Because I went through this whole process with everybody else.
Oh, as far as they were limiting what? Diamond
had that cooler. Yeah, so Diamond put the cooler out. That's when I started with Seller Central. Then I started running with Diamond again because I started talking to Corey Cassoni, and he's like, "Oh no, you can list with them. They're fine. It's going to be fine. Don't worry about it." So I listed with them again through Toonhound Studios, and got that whole thing going. And then things were going good with Diamond again, except for one of my titles. It was out of stock, and I couldn't get Diamond to make a restock. And this was the After Dark book that I knew was selling really well, and it was making me crazy because I was in the top 10 of my category a couple times on Amazon, and that's when the algorithm really kicks into play, and they weren't restocking. So then I got frustrated and launched with Amazon Advantage. It's because I knew, you know, they would see that there's books that are out of stock that are being sold really well. And then I got going with that again. And then, of course, no sooner did I get Amazon Advantage started when the restock order came from Diamond, and I'm back in good graces with Diamond again. So it came through a very organic process.
Right. Right. Okay, that answers that question. So, and then my other question is, with Amazon Advantage or with Diamond, I don't think this is the case with Diamond, but with Amazon Advantage, do you have to pay any warehousing fees for the dozens to hundreds of books you have in their holding?
No, there's no warehousing
okay.
fees from Diamond. No,
I mean specifically for Amazon Advantage. Sorry, that's the one.
No warehousing there either.
Okay.
And they're only buying literally like maybe 10 books at a time. They're buying very, very small numbers. And then if you outsell those, I'm sure, you know, the numbers go up.
Gotcha. Okay.
But there's no warehousing fees there. Now, this comes into a place that we really have to pause for a second. If you're thinking about doing this, remember, Diamond is going to basically sell your book at wholesale prices. So it's going to be 65% off the cover price. Is what they're selling that. So this is why it's so important to set a price, not based on what DC Comics is selling a graphic novel for, but based on what your specific costs are. And go back to our Patreon page. We've got information on how to properly set a price, along with a downloadable PDF that shows you exactly the math you got to do. If you're going to be considering distribution, you got to make sure that after you sell this for 65% off the cover price, that new price is still enough to cover your costs and leave you with a profit. Because Evil Inc. Volume 1, I got a 200 book order from Diamond, and I was doing print on demand, and at 65% off the cover price, I was paying money for Diamond to carry my books. I wasn't making enough profit. I was in the hole already. Right. I'd been successful, right, and I was in the hole. It was the worst. So by all means, don't do what I did. If you're going to do distribution, you got to call your shot early and make sure that your price is high enough that after you subtract 65% from that cover price, it still leaves you enough to cover your costs, your per unit costs, and give you a profit.
Right. And that, to give you numbers on that, one of the reasons why I priced the Drive hardcover at $50 is so that if I wholesale it at 50% off, say $25 going in, my unit cost to me is about $5. So I'm still making 20 on a wholesale sale of that book. And that's what Brad's talking about, is you want to make that price have enough buffer where even if you tag a big, deep discount on it, you're still walking away with a profit.
Yeah. And stop for a minute and think about what price really is. That price that you're printing on the book is meaningless in all other cases other than distribution. Because your book is $50, right, Dave?
Yeah.
If you wanted to, on your site, you could hold a quote-unquote sale and sell it for $40. Nobody's stopping
right,
you.
Right, right, right. No,
right? You can sell it for 30 if you like. Like if you're like me and you've got a Evil Inc. Volume 3 stacked to the ceiling in your basement because you bought too many of them. And it was the year before you went to color and they're black and white and nobody wants it. And the art's crappy on the cover and all this other stuff. And you got way too much of them. That was a $15 book. I regularly put it out for $5 just to get them out of the basement. Nobody's stopping me from having a sale, but in terms of how that's sent out to retail outlets, now it's really, you know, seriously important. But in terms of your sales, you can sell it for whatever you want, regardless of what you printed on the cover.
Right. Price is what people are willing to pay.
Yeah.
Exactly. So your advice is Diamond first, then if that's not working, Amazon Advantage, and then maybe not even go with Amazon Seller Central. Is that what I'm hearing?
I would say if Amazon Advantage isn't working out for you, then Seller Central is your last ditch effort of getting it out on Amazon. Yeah.
Right. Well, okay, so let me give you my experience both with Diamond and with Amazon, and this might help round out what Brad's advice was for you. So my experience with Diamond is that I feel like it's kind of a heavyset guy on the back of a loading dock with his pants a little bit fallen down, and he's scratching at his belly, and he's looking at a piece of paper going, all right, so you got some Sheldon books coming in? All right, we're going to need, well, we got to return half of these, and we're going to dent them up before we send them back to you, but here's a check. And we think the numbers are right on this check, it's free money that you didn't make, so that's fine. And my experience with Diamond has kind of been hit and miss in that they're not efficient because, frankly, their whole industry is not efficient. It's a really inefficient and friction-filled transmission of books to readers, right? You have all these different inputs going to a myriad of different outputs, and it's a million titles, and it's a lot of possibilities for things to get dinged and hit and scratched and not sold and then returned. But when it works, there's nice money in diamond. So that's been my experience with diamond. And then with Amazon, like Brad, I have found the few times that I've ever tried to approach it, Brad, and I'm glad to hear you steer me towards Amazon Advantage. I feel like the whole thing was designed by an engineer and no one ever took it through usability testing of like, hey, how are new people approaching Amazon to sell? And can they understand these 48 weird instructions that we have? Then we need to simplify this. When you find a usability thing where it's like, okay, clearly four engineers sat in a room and have never talked to another human being and these instructions are terrible. That's what I feel like Amazon has in terms of its interface.
Ooh. Remember when everybody was going to Amazon servers because they were super cheap or, you know, next to free? You know what I'm talking about?
I am. And the usability is terrible on Amazon. Like, the prices are great and the service is great, but the instructions are like, who designed this?
I've been very lucky in my life to not struggle with serious depression to the extent that what I'm going to say next, I realize that there are some people that actually say sentences like this, and it's not in jest. So I want you to know I get that, and I'm serious when I say I'm not taking this lightly. I came so close to slitting my wrists the weekend I tried to install Amazon server. Somebody had told me, oh, it's real easy. You can, and this was like a guy that ran servers and websites and stuff. This is real easy. You can set this up. And I had set it up, and all of my sites went down. You know, because you've got to do it, you know, in real life to see if it's really working.
Right.
My sites went down. And this was during the ad age where that meant I wasn't making money. And this was after I'd left my day job. So not making money was a serious issue. And I was down for days and spent an entire weekend trying to make this thing work. I'm not super smart, but I've been doing this for a long time. I kind of know how to find my way around stuff. I know how to Google resources to get tutorials and step-by-steps. I'm not a dummy. I could not make this thing work for the life of me. And then I brought people in that knew what they were doing. They couldn't do it. I finally ended up, the decision to go with DreamHost was the smartest decision I ever made in my life. And I left Amazon servers long in the background, and I will never touch those guys again. And by the way, Amazon Advantage, very similar user experience. They're better, but not by much, man. I really got to want those sales. Listen, if Amazon wasn't Amazon, I wouldn't be doing it. Right. But that's where book sales are.
This is what's weird. They have made the buying process so frictionless. And yet you go to try to sell something on Amazon and every step is friction. You know, it's like, what? What are they asking me to do? I don't understand any of this. And it's amazing to me that a company that is so focused on a user and making it instantaneous to buy has made it kind of tricky to sell. And maybe that's intentional. Maybe that bug is a feature that they don't want more than super serious people selling on Amazon. I don't know.
I definitely wondered that myself more than once or twice. But yeah, that's why I would give Dan, especially because, like with Diamond, once you get it past all of those hurdles, you ship those books out, and then, you know, now, and what you said about you're never sure whether the numbers are right. Diamond's reporting system is also not great. In other words, just finding out how many books did I sell. It's not. It's very dense. It's not direct. It's not a simple, you know, here's the number of books you sold. There's a lot of spreadsheets and numbers all over the place. It's not great.
And it's not only not great. It's not instantaneous. When you're coming from the internet world, where you can access a server right away, or you can access your Shopify and right away have complete numbers. What you're getting with Gary is, with Diamond, is you're getting Gary down in the warehouse has forwarded a piece of paper onto Alice in accounting, and Alice is putting that into a spreadsheet, and then Alice is going to maybe mail that to Susan, who's going to distribute that to the sellers, and you're going to get a piece of paper, and you're not going to, and you're going to still have a little bit of coffee stain from what Gary down at the dock was putting it on his book.
And so there's a lot of Garys out there.
It just feels like a Diamond, a little bit, feels like you're stepping back into 1975 in terms of book distribution when you're dealing with them. But as Brad said, though, when it works, you're like, oh, hey, great. They just sold 3,000. They sold 1,000 copies. They sold 2,000 copies.
Right.
Great. That's amazing. People I never would have sold to and wouldn't have access to. But there's also a lot of times where you're like, what is this piece of paper? What am I doing? You need what from me? Like, their communication is weird and they're a little bit behind the times. But that's kind of the nature of their business.
Yeah, it's not fun, but listen, this is part of the hard work of being an independent publisher. This is one that you just got to hold your nose and do.
So, Brad, short version, the big summary is you found this worth it, though, yeah?
Yes, I would not do it any other way. I mean, with all my complaints and all my belly aching, distributing is a really good idea. Reaching out to distributors and you can do that as a self-publisher. There's I know a lot of you are listening to this podcast and thinking, well, screw that. I'm just going to sign with a publisher and let them worry about all that. And that's a valid choice as long as you understand the consequence that has its own barrel of consequences that are going to come with that too. It's going to mean that now you've added another person in the process and they're going to want a piece of the pie. That's cool if you're operating at the volume that's not going to affect you personally. I don't know that I'm there at this point where that wouldn't affect me personally. I like all my pie. It's just something that a self-publisher has got to grapple with.
Yeah, I okay. Well, then I tell you what, I am going to look back into Diamond, especially with Drive Book 2 coming back out.
Oh, if I were you, I would so do that. Yes.
The question there is, I guess I have to solicit for Drive 1 and 2 if I'm going to try to sell 2, huh?
I would have, yeah.
Story based.
And why wouldn't you? You'd put out Drive 1 one month and then the next month come back with Drive 2.
Yeah, I guess, I'm living in a Brad Geiger universe now. I'm ready to do it. Honestly, you've convinced me. I'm going to try it again.
I so think that you should.
All righty. Well, on that note, my friends, I think we've successfully wrapped up another Comic Lab, my friend Bradley J. Geigy. Or what did I call you at the beginning of the show? Geigy?
Geigly. That was an adverb.
Geigly? All right, Brad Geigly.
Well, on that note, you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been the always delightful Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com, cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com, and cartoonist that you can find on amazon.com at reasonable prices and fair shipping.
And Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions at www.woodsong.media.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice. patreon.com/comiclab. But up, 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 but up,